Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we will speak with Jesse O'Connell. He is a Senior Vice President of Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. And we're going to talk to him about the Biden administration's student loan debt relief. It is a bigger deal than I thought, I think than a lot of people thought, and it is pissing off all the right people this week. So that's a positive. Then we'll be joined by Alec Karakatsanis, the Executive Director of Civil Rights Corps, about the pervasive power of pro-police propaganda, or copaganda, to shape perceptions of crime and influence related public policy. So, and Alec is a really good person. He is an excellent analyst, and he debunks a lot of conventional wisdom around crime and policing. But first, we dodged a bullet this week when Pat Ryan won a special election in my own district here in New York. I warned you all last week that if the Republican had flipped the seat, we would have been inundated with lazy punditry about the salience of Roe being overturned, being a mirage, or blather about voters being more concerned with inflation than the GOP's growing extremism or threats to democracy, whatever it was going to be. And I just want to point out that before the votes were tallied on Tuesday, the firm Data for Progress, which is known for very accurate polling, came out with a survey of New York 19 that found Republican Mark Molinaro up by 8 points. 8 points. So Pat Ryan ended up winning by around 3. So that was a polling error of 3 points. And in the averages, Molinaro had been favored as well. By the way, let me just insert something. You're reading a lot about how this was a shocking result, a big surprise win. I live here, and that's nonsense, right? I didn't think Pat Ryan had it in the bag or anything like that, but I thought it was very likely that he would win, in part because they out-hustled Molinaro, right? I mean, it was Pat Ryan's people who were everywhere. Pat Ryan had the signs everywhere. It was just, if you lived in this district, it wasn't surprising at all. Anyway, there was this massive polling error. And if you look at new voter registrations post-Dobbs, that is, after this rogue right-wing Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, they skew largely female, they skew younger, and they skew Democratic. That's who's registering for the first time to vote. And I don't want to be Pollyannish here, but I would urge everyone to ignore the polls even more than I usually do, because we are in entirely uncharted territory. You're hearing a lot about still how the media is fixated on this idea of a red wave coming, right? Republicans are going to win, and they are favored to win the House, but win control of the House. But I'm saying, you should really not pay too much attention, because this is our first midterm election after a major party attempted a coup. It's the first midterm following the Supreme Court stripping away long-held rights. And it's a midterm that's happening while people are fearful about violent extremism on the right. And here's the thing about newly registered voters. A lot of them won't make it past a poll's likely voter screen. And let me explain what that is. So pollsters can survey everyone, or they can survey registered voters, or they can survey people who are likely to vote, who they determine are likely to vote. As we get closer to an election, and this happens every cycle, most pollsters will start to set up those screens. They'll start screening for likely voters. And one way they decide who is a likely voter is their past voting history, right? Now, let's say you are someone who hasn't been politically active, but you are pissed off and fearful about what Republicans are doing. And you decide, I'm going to register for the first time. Well, you're probably not going to be included in polls of likely voters because you don't have a history. So I just think you know, the a key takeaway is that all bets are off. The right is energized, certainly. They're pissed off about whatever conspiracy theories they see on right-wing media or whatever bullshit they believe about, you know, gender-affirming care or critical race theory, whatever. And our side is fired up over the rise of these, like, fascist insurrectionists in one of our major parties. And they're fired up by, you know, the right's disregard for the consequences of these abortion bans. And they're fired up by, you know, thugs turning up at school boards and closing libraries for books because they have books that they don't like. And, you know, there's more of us. I wish we would have an election that wasn't the most important election of our lives, but that just seems to be the way it goes right now. For a variety of not great reasons. So again, I'd say just put your head down and ignore the polls, because I think there's going to be some big surprises coming in November. And let's just do our best to beat these belligerent extremists in November. And on that note, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back.
She preferred the tighter ones, the sharp, controlled jerk, swinging left to right before driving back to the right, only so she could do it all over again, until after enough speed and enough wind and more distance than I'd been prepared to expect, taking me to parts of the city I rarely think of and never visit, I heard her say,
welcome back. Here's a pattern I've observed with the Biden administration, or the Biden administration in a 50-50 Senate, if you will. You get a policy proposal. And my fellow progressives, they grouse that it is, you know, way too modest or centrist. Then the details come out, and it turns out that most of the experts and a lot of advocates, a lot of progressive advocates, are really happy. And as you dig into the fine print, you realize that this modest proposal, whatever it is actually really intelligently drawn up and more far-reaching than you had thought. Our next guest can tell us if Joe Biden's cancellation of up to $20,000 in student loan debt fits that pattern. I'm happy to be joined by Jesse O'Connell, who is a Senior Vice President of Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. Jesse, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Good morning. It's really great to be here.
Thanks for taking the time. So let's see, how big of a deal is this? First, how many people are going to see some relief here?
So it's a very big deal. And, you know, I think the early numbers out from the administration are indicating that we could see this relief really reach up to 43 million borrowers, including, you know, 27 million who might qualify for that larger of the two amounts that we saw in the top line forgiveness numbers that were shared yesterday.
Right. So it's been sold as like this $10,000 forgiveness, but Pell Grant recipients can get up to $20,000 in relief, and 60% of student loan holders are Pell Grant recipients. So it should have been sold as up to $20,000 in debt cancellation. As Jesse mentioned, according to the Department of Education, 27 million people can get up to that $20,000 forgiven. And I think the debt cancellation has been the primary focus of the media coverage this week, but I'm not sure it's the most significant measure in this executive order, or certainly not the only one. Can you talk about some of the rest? What are some of the other kinds of relief in there besides just canceling debt?
Yeah, and you touched on this in your open, and I think it's one of the most important things that I want people to take away is both the thoughtfulness and the thoroughness of this this proposal. You know, I think rightfully media coverage has focused on the forgiveness element. That has been what the dialogue has been leading up. That's what we've seen sort of, you know, sustained activist energy and attention to, you know, in the months leading up to this. But some of the elements that are the most important for borrowers are the extending the payment pause through the end of the year. It's this new income-driven repayment plan that's going to cap payments at 5% of income for many people. And then for some borrowers, reach that forgiveness threshold after 10 years. You know, I mean, this is going to reduce payments to very low monthly amounts for many people, and, you know, savings of upwards of $1,000 a year for a lot of borrowers. So I think the story that was told by yesterday's announcement was one of an administration who is thinking comprehensively about why we landed in this place, right? That sort of not looking at the existence of student debt as a one-off isolated concern that was important to address, and it is important to address, but that this was their kind of opening salvo, their significant down payment on addressing the persistent challenges of unaffordable college that we've really seen get worse and worse for this generation of students.
And just so listeners know, when Jesse was saying that we're gonna cap the student loan payments at 5%, that's half of the existing cap, right? So right now you can pay up to 10% of your income out for student loans. And that's going to be a really significant difference. If you have a smaller loan, they are currently, or before this measure was passed, they were forgiven after 20 years. Now it'll be 10 years. There's a lot of changes like that that are, really significant. Jesse, if you look at an average white family with the exact same income as a black family, the former, that is the white family, will have about 7 times more accumulated wealth, the 7 times the net worth, at the same income levels. Now, the administration is saying that this is a measure that could help close that racial wealth gap. Is that a credible claim? And how might that work?
I think it's a very credible claim. I mean, you know, the underlying data, in the student loan system, we've known for a long time that black students are more likely to have borrowed to have to go to college in the first place. We know that black borrowers are twice as likely to have had Pell Grants. And we know that because of, you know, persistent inequities in the labor market and sort of all of the systemic issues that we've struggled with when it comes to disparities across racial groups, we know that the burden of student loans has often fallen much harder on these communities. You know, when you look at sort of the amount that's owed after 12 years, those balances have just continued to grow, and it's prevented many black students from getting the return on that credential that they borrowed for in the first place. So I think the fact that this assistance will really address some of those groups in a very sort of direct and targeted way is very much the credit of this program. And I think, you know, you framed it correctly, right? Which is what we're trying to tackle here is these persistent gaps in wealth. And I think we're going to see some progress on that as a result of this action.
I want to ask you to kind of just respond to a few of the criticisms. There's a lot of like silly criticism out there, and I'm not going to make you respond to goofiness, but to what degree could this be a measure that drives up inflation?
So I think inflation is the wrong lens to look at this action through, right? I think for a couple of reasons. One, the fact that part of this announcement, you know, said that student loan repayments are going to resume in January, right? That's inherently a disinflationary activity, right? Like people are going to start to pay back their loans, 3-4 months from now. But even beyond that, you know, student loans, we have not been making student loan payments since the onset of the pandemic. It's not like there was sort of some there's not going to be a change in ongoing and underlying economic activity because of this. And I think really it's missing the point that this is addressing household circumstances holistically, right? We just touched on the fact, you know, this is really about wealth. It's about the ability for families to plan for the future. It has these really kind of important effects on the mindset that a lot of households and a lot of working class households are going to be having going forward because this debt burden has been reduced, has been lifted, has been dropped to zero for a great many people. And I think thinking about that in kind of like overall household financial health is a much better frame for the results of this action.
Yeah, I think so too. By the way, if you had made any payments on your student loans since the payment pause began in March of 2020, you can get that money back. Under this new executive order, you can just get it all refunded. You can talk to your loan servicer if that describes you. is, so a lot of people, including people, I should say, that had huge PPP loans forgiven in the past couple of years, they say this is a bailout for mostly affluent people, won't help, quote, ordinary Americans. And you're hearing this line, like, how can you look, you know, a nurse in the face or whatever, they, you know, breaking out these kind of like imaginary yeoman working class people. How much of this is targeted to people who are lower on the income level? How much of this is going to be benefiting people who are affluent and don't need it?
Yeah, you know, the degree to which those complaints just don't stand up to even the slightest bit of scrutiny, it's really striking in all this, right? You know, 90% of this relief is going to go to households that are making $75,000 or less. And even before this action, we knew that within the loan portfolio, 97% of all borrowers made less than $150,000 a year, right? So even with the income caps in this program, we're still targeting most people that have student loans, and most people that are not, as you just described, these wealthy business owners, you know, these people that are having thriving careers. If you're making a lot of money, your decision to go to college paid off. You've made progress on your student loans, right? So I think the other half of the argument that I have seen a little bit less attention on, and it just, it's very revealing about how people think about college and how they think about opportunity in this country. You know, home health aides have student loans. Early childhood educators have student loans. People in tons of working class professions have student loans because so many different elements of our workforce, of our economy, look for a skilled credential. It's how we indicate that, you know, you have the ability to do something. So people have been borrowing for these things. And crucially, they've been borrowing at relatively small amounts. But it's those lower loan balances that have been most persistently challenging for people because they either attempted a degree or credential and they didn't complete, or they got that credential and it hasn't kind of paid off for them in the way that they thought. So, you know, to sort of suggest that rich people have student loans and working class people don't is just really profoundly misunderstanding the lived experience of many, many people in this country.
I must say, Jesse, that I've been pleasantly surprised at how much this move has pissed off some really awful people. And I think advocates could have been more explicit in pitching this as a benefit. Like, they could have said that this will make everyone who writes for Reason magazine cry. And I would have been on board. I mean, that would have made me more enthusiastic. Why do you think it is that we always shovel massive subsidies out the door all the time, much of which goes to more affluent people, from home mortgage deductions to subsidized retirement accounts to like business loans and credits and all the rest. And those benefits, you never see this kind of freak out about how they're a moral hazard or how they're going to drive up inflation. Then you try to help some people, you know, who are struggling under student loan debt, and all of a sudden it's an existential threat. Oh, why do you think that is?
So I have been thinking about this a lot recently, and I think one of the reasons must be tied to the fact that this college affordability crisis has sort of been kind of a slow boil, slowly building thing that, you know, is not super evident to people unless you kind of work on the issue or you and your family are trying to pursue post-secondary education. But I think a lot of the people that you just described that are kind of engaged in that discourse about being outraged that we are taking action to help people in these circumstances is because college used to be affordable for them, right? You know, for a previous generation of students, we made significant, meaningful public investments at the state level primarily to ensure that an education after high school was affordable to those who pursued it. And as we increasingly lean on student loans to paper over, you know, that lack of investment over time, and as it sort of built an economy that looked for more credentialed workers, this is built. So I think part of it is there are a lot of people that just fundamentally don't understand how that landscape has changed, how this is not about choice. This is not about, you know, oh, I chose to do something and now I don't like how that worked out and I want someone to help me. You know, this is people doing the right thing. This is people, you know, taking the advice that is given about how to succeed in America and what our economy needs, and then getting to the other end and finding out that promise is not being delivered on. So I think a lot of this is just kind of a really great example of what government should do, right? Government should be there to help people when they find themselves in a circumstance that they did everything that they should have. and still are looking for a delivery on the outcome that they expected.
That's a good answer. Yeah, I think part of it is also just natural curmudgeonly. Like, this is people think, oh, you know, young kids, get off my lawn. Folks, you know, if you are a risk taker in business and you find yourself under a mountain of debt, you can seek bankruptcy protection. And in 2005, under the auspices of, I think it was 2005, I mean, don't quote me on the date, on the year, under the auspices of bankruptcy reform, they made it impossible to get out of student loan debt by declaring bankruptcy. So that they said, oh, this one debt, we're just going to stick that with you for your whole life. There's no way out. And here we are 17 or so years later saying, okay, we're going to actually do something about this because it is a crisis. Jesse O'Connell, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
It was a great conversation. I'm really glad I had the chance to be here.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with a look at how the legacy media is influenced by propaganda. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm very pleased to be joined by Alec Karakatsanis. He's a former defense attorney. He's the founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps. He also writes a Substack newsletter called Alec's Propaganda Newsletter. And he's also a really good follower on Twitter. You should follow him at Equality Alec, all one word. Alec, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I first heard the word propaganda sometime, I think in the past 5 or 10 years. Can you just briefly define it for us? What do you mean by that?
I think it's a general term that tries to describe a very particular form of propaganda that is designed to change and manipulate the way that we think about the role of police, prosecutors, prisons, and the sort of punishment bureaucracy. And I think it really has like three main functions in our current society. I mean, number one, the first thing propaganda tries to do is narrow our conception of what safety means to only that very small fraction of harms that police actually engage in any kind of workaround. And that is, typically almost exclusively crimes committed by the poor. So when you hear cops talking about crime, they're not talking about wage theft, which is $50 billion a year, five times all other crime, property crime combined, or tax evasion, $1 trillion a year, 63 times all other property crime combined, right? They're not talking about the numerous millions of illegal assaults that police themselves commit, right? So they want to narrow our conception of safety away from things like air pollution, which kills 100,000 people every single year in the U.S., five times all murder combined, or water pollution, et cetera. The second major function of propaganda, in my opinion, is it constantly wants people to think that this very narrow range of crime is increasing. There's constant fear-mongering in the news. And as a result, if you look at surveys over the last 25 years, people who live in the U.S. consistently and repeatedly and pervasively misunderstand and overestimate the likelihood of certain types of crime committed by the poor. And then I think the final and most important part of propaganda, the third big thing it does, which is pervasive in the news media, is it constantly tries to link systems of punishment that are very profitable to a lot of corporations, police, prosecutors, police unions, judges, courts, probation, parole. It tries to link this entire big bloated bureaucracy to safety in ways that are actually completely inconsistent with the evidence. It's like climate science denial. So like what we actually know about crime is that the root causes of crime are things like inequality, poverty, lack of access to medical care, mental health treatment, drug addiction, lack of access to supportive housing, lack of early childhood education resources, et cetera. These are the things that actually determine crime. And much of the media is constantly engaged in propaganda to get us to think that little small tweaks in things that police, prosecutors, or judges or prisons are doing are actually meaningfully affecting crime. And I think that's the worst part of it.
It's funny that you identify three forms of propaganda and didn't mention what I think is the most common, which is just whitewashing specific cases of abuse by police and accepting their uncritically their official story. I mean, we saw it with certainly in Uvalde, Texas, where there were 16 different versions of events, all of which turned out to be bullshit and all of which were embraced by the news media, uncritically, until being disproven. And that was a story with a lot of public attention. And most of the time, there isn't that follow through where, you know, they will accept the initial version of events that you get from police. And then you never hear any kind of like, oh, we got this one wrong, as you did in that case. Let's dig into a couple specifics here. So Bloomberg News ran a story about crime in New York City a few weeks back. The headline was "Fear of Rampant Crime is Derailing New York City's Recovery." And the article noted that, and I quote, "incidents of violent crime remain at historic lows in New York City, but people's views on guns and crime are often more influenced by what they see and hear rather than by hard numbers." It's very interesting to have that in a news story, it didn't really mention the media's role in all of this. It did mention this little bit of data, which I think was interesting. A Quinnipiac poll in February found that 3/4 of New Yorkers said crime was a very serious problem. When they first asked that in 1999, the murder rate was 50% higher than it is today. But at that time, only 35% of respondents ranked violence as a major concern. So there is this disconnect that is really prevalent. Let me ask you this. As far as how widespread crime is, the trends, I mean, what is the reality here?
Well, let me first just say, relating to your point, Bloomberg published another investigation a few weeks ago that I covered pretty extensively on Twitter, that showed, that plotted the number of mentions of shootings with the number of actual shootings, and showed that, you know, ever since Eric Adams was elected, an extraordinary disconnect between the number of mentions of that kind of crime and the number of actual crimes. Dramatic increase. And the sort of the upshot of it all is that rather than like an objective increase in crime causing the public agenda to shift, it's actually the coordinated and quite effective public relations campaign of a particular powerful official. And I think that helps understand, you know, if you look at the very recent 2022 data on this, you can sort of see how what the media covers and what the media treats as urgent is not based on some objective analysis of what is most harmful to the most number of people. If that were the case, you'd see the media doing front page stories every night on how many people are dying because of poverty and the 10 million people around the world who die every year because of air pollution alone. But that's not how the media is deciding what stories are important. The media's fundamentally sort of the pipeline to the media is fundamentally corrupted by powerful political interests. And right here is a really important point. One of the big differences from 1999 to the present, although this was still a problem in the late 90s, is police departments have become a lot more sophisticated operators of propaganda. They, in fact, devote tens of millions of dollars to shaping the news. We recently found out in the wake of the 2020 protests that the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department has 42 full-time employees dedicated to manipulating public relations. The LAPD has another 25 employees dedicated to that. So that's 67 employees in just the two largest of the over 30 police departments in one city alone who are dedicated to public relations. And what does that mean? It means planting these stories. It means building relationships with journalists. It means giving journalists so-called experts to quote. It means producing data. It means manipulating that data. It means doing social media. It means going to the scene of crimes and talking to people's families and victims to sort of shift the narrative immediately after a police shooting, which is what these units actually do. So it's not surprising that people's perceptions of crime are so skewed when there's an entire industry. I haven't even mentioned the police unions and the for-profit multi-billion dollar prison industry consultants that also do this work. So it's a pretty daunting task what we're up against in terms of just giving the public very basic, accurate information.
Yeah, it is. But so just to follow up, where are we at crime in this country? I mean, it seems like we had a very long reduction in violent crime and an uptick that coincided with the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, crime is not one monolithic category. Crime is many, many different things, including illegal dumping of chemicals into the water supply by many corporations or tax evasion by the rich, like I mentioned earlier. So what you have to understand is when the media talks about so-called crime rates, it's actually only talking usually about what are called index crimes, which are the very, very narrow range of crimes that the FBI has chosen to track. And even then, it's only talking about index crimes from the police departments that report their data to the FBI. I think so far in 2022, that the results haven't come out yet for 2021 yet, but so far, I think only 40% of the police departments in the country haven't even produced that data to the FBI. So it's very, very narrow and very, very skewed. But even on those index crimes, all of those index crimes are near historic lows. You know, they're far lower than they were in the 1990s. They ticked up a little bit during the pandemic, particularly a couple of them. You know, some of them are still down during the pandemic, but some of them, like gun shootings and homicides, ticked up in many places with conservative prosecutors and conservative governments, places with more sort of neoliberal governments. You know, there was a consistent increase during the pandemic when life changed for so many people in shootings and murders, but it's still far lower than it was in the 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there is a really common issue here, which is this uncritical acceptance of claims, again, by some of the same people that you were just talking about, police unions, police departments themselves, that various criminal justice reforms. And I want to point out, it doesn't seem like the specifics matter much here, but any criminal justice reform is said to lead to higher crime. So you get this dichotomy in the reporting. You get soft on crime policies and tough or hard on crime policies. And you'll frequently see news reports that, you know, conflate causation and correlation. So it's important, that point that you just made, that whatever crime trends we've seen in the last couple of years have been evident in places that instituted criminal justice reforms and places that did not. The uptick during the pandemic doesn't seem to me to be a huge mystery. There was a lot of dislocation. A lot of people were isolated. There was a lot of anxiety. There was a very significant increase in gun ownership, including among first-time gun owners. At the same time, there were some criminal justice reforms passed in certain places, notably cash bail reform. And a ton of articles kind of attributed the rise of gun crimes and related things to these so-called soft-on-crime policies. And by the way, I think listeners need to understand that there are a lot of ostensibly liberal people, liberal pundits, liberal writers who embrace copaganda for whatever reason. Alec wrote about Alec McGillis, another Alec, a piece that he wrote that was particularly egregious piece for The Atlantic a few weeks back, in which he claimed that the cause of a recent crime wave that he basically invented was a backlog in jury trials combined with cash bail reform. And then, Alec, you recently tangled with a couple of pundits from the Young Turks who were actually attacking my former colleague, Tana Ganeva, for defending cash bail reform. Now, in that instance, there was a story of a guy who was out on bail when he attacked someone. It was a ghastly story. But here we have an example that might be instructive in a couple ways. First, there was the use of an anecdote. And I think this is really common with the bail issue in that, you know, sometimes people out on bail, whether with a bond or not, are going to commit a crime. What is the larger reality of cash bail reform? And how common is it that you're seeing anecdotes applied to a whole policy change?
What we're seeing now is the return of Willie Horton-style politics.
Willie Horton, yes.
It's basically like denying climate change is real. We have overwhelming evidence that the actual causes of fluctuations in crime, like significant fluctuations in crime, actual causes, are deep structural things about our society and our culture, right? They are not little policy tweaks that punishment bureaucrats like prosecutors, police, judges, courts make. So that's the number one point. Like, to blame significant fluctuations either way on the policies of these people and even fairly minor policy shifts, right, is absolutely absurd. There's no evidence to support it whatsoever. The thing about bail is, though, there is overwhelming evidence that detaining people, even for short periods of time, because they can't pay money bail or for other reasons, actually increases the crime they commit in the future. Not by a lot, but it increases it, right? So it's not a major fluctuation in society-wide crime. It doesn't explain why the U.S. is a more violent place than, like, countries with better social safety nets and less inequality, right? But it does actually increase crime to keep people in jail after you arrest them. We know that. That has been studied. That's not disputed in the literature, right? So what you've got is a lot of these news media outlets and sort of pundits who don't know anything about what they're talking about doing Willie Horton-style politics. Of course there's going to be examples of people who are released on bail who commit a crime, just like there's going to be examples of people who aren't out on bail who commit crimes. Like, people commit crimes. Yeah. And so what they're doing, though, is they're taking an example of someone being released on a crime, making a huge story of it in order to push more regressive policies that will lead to more people who are presumed innocent being locked up in horrific conditions like Rikers Island. And all of that is being done in service of an anti-science agenda, because what we know is that locking them up not only destroys their lives, like creates billions of dollars in community economic damages and costs the government billions of dollars in needless human caging costs. And it separates millions of children from their parents every single year. I mean, it's just terrible social policy.
Yeah, it is. Let's talk about something that you've written about quite a bit. The sourcing for news articles about crime. And you've written a couple of pieces recently calling out the New York Times specifically for this. So official sources and also their choices of experts that they quote when they do a story about crime. What kind of patterns have you seen in terms of not just the New York Times, but the media's choices of who to go and, you know, what experts to go and reach out to, and how does that shape news coverage and ultimately people's perceptions?
This is a fascinating topic. And if you're interested in more depth on it, you know, I've written about this pretty extensively in my Copaganda newsletter, which is a free newsletter I started writing about Copaganda on Substack. So I encourage you to check that out if you're interested in this more deeply. I wrote a separate piece on ordinary sourcing and a separate piece on experts. So, you know, on ordinary sourcing, there's a few really important points. Like, number one, the sourcing for the vast bulk of articles about so-called, you know, criminal justice issues or crime or safety in our society are cops, prosecutors, and police unions, right? Occasionally, there will be toward the end of an article, sort of like the obligatory quote from some, you know, person who's a public defender or some kind of like activist, right? But they're often non-existent, and when they're there, they're buried toward the end of the article, and they've had nothing to do with how the article is framed. Because keep in mind, when you look at an article and you see the sources that are mainly cited in it, what you have to understand is that there's a process going on behind the scenes where those people are usually the ones who are actually shaping the story. They might have been the ones that pitched the story to the journalist. They're certainly the ones that are shaping the thesis or the angle that the story is coming from, the framing of it, right? And so that is by and large happening with people who have a vested interest in maintaining the size and power of the carceral system. So what I've started to do in my Substack is I just went through a bunch of prominent articles from the New York Times and other places, and I just listed for people who the sources are in chronological order in all these stories. And you, when you look at it that way, the patterns are absolutely incredible. The second thing with experts is, who is portrayed as an expert is a very political decision, and how that person is discussed. So one big thing that New York Times and other outlets do is they often will say that someone is a analyst or a professor or an expert without noting that the person used to work for the police, or without noting that the person has lucrative contracts with a private weapons corporation or a private policing training corporation that has a certain vested interest in their opinion. So they're just hiding from people the web of financial interest that links many of the people that are presented to us as experts. And then also another practice that I think is particularly troubling is these outlets will say something like, well, experts say this or experts believe that, to convey some sort of fake sense that there's this consensus of experts around a particular point. And they'll often do this on very controversial points that are actually not a consensus of experts, where many people actually disagree with that, including the most prominent experts in the world. So when you actually look at the scientific evidence and you look at some of this coverage, it's as if publications of the New York Times are repeatedly publishing things like, experts agree that there is no such thing as global warming. I mean, that's the level of deception that we're seeing in coverage of the police.
Yeah. It's a telling example. Before I let you go, I just want to ask briefly about the Biden administration's so-called Safer America plan. It's an executive order they issued earlier this month. It had some unobjectionable stuff in it about training and blah, blah, blah. But it also provides funding for putting 100,000 more cops on American streets. We already spend more on policing than any other country. We don't have low crime rates, you know, relative to our wealth. Is there any evidence that more cops leads to less, even index crimes, as you were talking about?
Not only is there no serious evidence for that fact, but there is extraordinary evidence that spending money on other interventions that actually tackle the root causes of crime is the way to produce safety for our communities. Yeah. But I want to make one other point about Biden's plan. It's not just that 100,000 new cops doesn't help our communities become safer. We are facing an unprecedented wave of authoritarian organizing in this country, unprecedented attempt to criminalize reproductive health. With Biden trying to add 100,000 new cops, he's giving thousands of cops to Ron DeSantis, to Greg Abbott, to fascists all over the country at a time when they are criminalizing basic aspects of women's health and many other issues, by the way. These are highly sophisticated, militarized agencies that have access to the latest surveillance technology. It's baffling to me that more Democrats aren't talking about the dangers of another 100,000 of these people. And keep in mind, cops are one of the most successful and highly organized right-wing and largely Republican forces in our society.
Yes.
Adding 100,000 of them is an incredible boost to the power of police unions and to the money at their disposal that they use in elections all over the country. And these are armed people, right? These are fundamental structural things you're doing to our society that make it forever hard to do progressive things. Because keep in mind, since 1900, one of the main functions of police in this country's history, in every region of the country, in every city, county, and state, has been to crush, infiltrate, and surveil progressive social movements. They did it when women were seeking the right to vote. They did it in the Jim Crow era and the civil rights era. They did it to the Black liberation movements in the 1960s and 70s. They did it to the animal rights movement. They're doing it now to the environmental movement. They're doing it now to the reproductive health justice movement. This is what cops do. And the main opponent of cops over the last 125 years has been organized labor. They have crushed worker organizing all over the country, ruthlessly enforcing the interests of for-profit employers. And I think that's just people just don't really realize the history of what cops do and how they've been used and how they can be used by people who own things to crush all of the rest of us.
Yes, I agree. It seems like this move by the administration was politically defensive, and that is connected with what we're talking about today, the widespread embrace of propaganda by the legacy media and by some liberals. It reinforces inherently conservative narratives about crime being out of control in cities and the idea that it's a result of like progressive prosecutors and bail reform and the like. This is all a big reason why Democrats always seem to be on the defensive about crime, even as their policies are more suited to address the root issues, the root causes. They're defensive about it as a political issue. It also explains why Republicans can, you know, call for defunding the FBI or suggest that cops and white collar criminals should enjoy impunity, and nobody ever accuses them of being soft on crime. These things are interconnected. Alec Karakatsanis, we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Folks, check out Alec's Copaganda newsletter. He's also, as I said, a good follow on Twitter at EqualityAlec. I'd also like to thank Jesse O'Connell and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. I dare form a leg and barrel. Learn on Bernie Parker. Take my back.